Dr. Ruth Westheimer, known affectionately as Dr. Ruth, has distinguished herself as a psychosexual therapist. She has a master's degree in sociology from the New School of Social Research and a doctorate of education from Columbia. She has taught at, among other places, Columbia and West Point. She is the author of numerous books, including Dr. Ruth's Guide to Safer Sex and Surviving Salvation, which is based on her PBS documentary about Ethiopian Jews. From her radio broadcasts to her television shows, including Ask Dr. Ruth, What's Up, Dr. Ruth, and most recently, Never Too Late, Dr. Ruth has provided advice and counseling to thousands of people. In addition to helping to solve the specific problems of her listeners and patients, Dr. Ruth has made a more general contribution to our culture. That is, by her honest, friendly, and direct approach to sexual issues, she has helped to make it acceptable to discuss sex openly, even in polite company. And for that, we owe her thanks. So won't you please welcome Dr. Ruth Westheimer.
You mean even to the Bostonians? Even among the Bostonians. Here is what I would like to suggest. Let me talk for a little while, and then let's have a nice discussion, because I like when it is a group like this one, because you can get up, I can hear you, and you never have to say I. You can say, a friend of mine. So I would like to put a few issues on the table so that we have a common ground for discussion. I have to say first a few things about the background, the Victorian Puritan background that all of us here come from. Where the Victorian mother used to tell her daughter, lie back and think of England. There is nothing in it for you. Don't expect the earth to shake. Don't expect the stars to twinkle. Don't expect orgasms. And you want to be married, so that's what you have to do. And I did talk about that Victorian mother some time ago, on British television. And believe me, that Great Britain is not the same. It has nothing to do with what is happening today about the royal family, but in general about the attitude towards sexuality. Another issue to put on the table is that people come from different backgrounds, with different beliefs, from different religious backgrounds, with a different morality and values. And for some people, the right time to be sexually active is after the wedding ceremony. And to these people I say, don't let anybody pressure you. Don't let anybody say, everybody is doing it, what's the matter with you, you are now a freshman at Harvard, you ought to do it already. Don't let anybody do that, because that very first sexual experience you will never forget. And it's a pity to do that just in order not to have that peer pressure. Another issue to put on the table, not for one moment. Today is my wedding anniversary. I'm married 31 years. Not for one moment do I think that sex is everything in a relationship. There is love, there is companionship, there is raising of children, there are many other components in a relationship. But you have not asked me to come and talk about the family, past, present, and future. We have decided to talk about the issue of sexuality. So I'm carving out that one aspect about that relationship which is talking about sex. When I talk about sex, keep in mind the general picture. I do believe that we have to be sexually literate. That the more we educate, the more we talk to groups like yours here, the less there will be problems. And sex therapists, I'm going to give you some examples, sex therapists don't have to worry. There is plenty of work for them to do out there. But I do believe that it behooves us that we must, especially in this country, and I'm going to tell you why I say especially in this country, we in the Western world have the best scientifically validated data about human sexual functioning that has ever been available. When I say in the Western culture, I mean this country, Europe, Australia, New Zealand, we do have scientifically validated data. In this country, from 1948, Kinsey, who did a tremendous questionnaire survey about the knowledge, attitude, and practice of the American male and the American female. After Kinsey, it's only 20, 25 years ago, Masters and Johnson have actually, and then Helen Singer Kaplan at Cornell, who trained me, I was there for 7 years, 2 years of training and 5 years on the staff. But Masters and Johnson particularly, they actually observed in a laboratory setting 140,000 sexual intercourse episodes. People actually having sex. Computers recording, penises wired up, lubrication in the vagina measured, heartbeat measured, brain waves measured, sweating measured, size of penis measured, everything that could be measured was measured. And you are going to say, who is willing to perform the sex act in a laboratory setting with people watching and computers recording? And I'm going to tell you, there were many medical students who needed money. There were some law students, Harvard law students, who needed money. And then there were people, there were prostitutes who needed money. And then there were people who volunteered for the sake of scientific investigation. Now, you here are very fortunate. Because from a group like this, if I were involved in these kind of painstaking, scientifically validated studies, from a group like this, I would ask for volunteers. But I'm not involved in these studies. I only take their data in order to teach and talk about issues of sexuality. So you can relax, I'm not going to ask for volunteers here. A sex educator like myself has an obligation not only to talk about research, which I'm going to do in a moment, but also to bury some of the myth that all of us have been growing up with. Let me give you an example. I'm going to talk more about that issue when I talk about the Safer Sex book. Look how interesting. In the English language, there is another term for masturbation. And that term is onanism. Your human sexuality textbooks, the heading is not masturbation, but onanism. In German, the term for masturbation is onanieren. And in Hebrew, the term for masturbation is leonen. Now, whose name of a man from the Old Testament do you hear When I say onanism, leonen, or onanieren, a man from the Old Testament. Somebody? Onan. Onan. An A plus in my classroom over there. Onan in the Old Testament was punished because he spilled his seed in vain. It says in Hebrew, Hushafach Zera Vashar. Onan did not masturbate. Onan spilled his seed in vain and was punished because he disobeyed. Because according to the rules and regulations of that society, Onan was supposed to impregnate his brother's wife. He didn't want to do that. The brother had died, didn't leave children. Onan didn't want to impregnate her because if a son would have been born, the son would have said the prayer of the dead after the brother, so he disobeyed. All of us live with misinterpretations and with myth like that. I'll give you another one. There, in the Middle Ages, they used to believe, and that's particularly important for you women here, they used to believe that during menstruation, there is no blood in the brain. All the blood from the brain goes to the uterus. So you know what they used to say? Let's not educate women. 5 days out of each month, there is no blood in their brains. Why waste education on women? We are living with these myths, and that's why it's so difficult to talk openly about issues of sexuality. The attitude towards sexuality starts when a baby is born. The way that baby is being diapered, that gives the message about the attitude towards sexuality. Now, I do not want in Massachusetts kindergarten teachers tomorrow morning to go to their kindergarten class, say 1, 2, 3, pull your pants down, we'll teach you how to masturbate. But we have to be able to talk about that issue. Not in a way that anybody has to report what they do. There are two schools of thoughts in terms of teaching sexuality. One is, there are some people, and I do not subscribe to that, there are some people who say, if you want to talk openly about these issues, you have to say about your own practice. I do not believe in that. I'm old-fashioned, I'm a square, I can stand here for 1 week, talk about nothing else but about sexuality without ever asking a personal question. I'll tell you why that is also so important. First of all, we have to talk about issues of unwanted pregnancies, because we are a strange society. We can send a man to the moon, we can have a Harvard University, and we don't have a perfect contraceptive. We still have 1.5 million unwanted pregnancies. And most of these unwanted pregnancies are out of ignorance, out of this sexual illiteracy that I talk about. The other day at a university, a young woman said, Dr. Westheimer, I don't understand how come I got pregnant. We did it standing up, and she douched with a soft drink right afterwards. Here she's pregnant. Another one said, Dr. Westheimer, I swear to you, I did not enjoy it. Somebody told her, if she holds back, if she doesn't have an orgasm, she wouldn't get pregnant, and here she's pregnant. And then at another university, a student said, Dr. Westheimer, he said that he has tremendous control. He knows when to pull out. And then she said, and you know, he really did pull out. She could feel the ejaculate on her thigh, and here she's pregnant. And that's out of ignorance. Because the two of them never had an opportunity to sit around talking. Otherwise, they would have known. that the erect penis, there is a pre-ejaculatory droplet of fluid before any ejaculation occurs. That pre-ejaculatory droplet of fluid contains thousands of spermatozoa. How many sperm are needed to get her pregnant? One fast one. You see, psychologically speaking, not only sexually speaking, psychologically speaking, coitus interruptus, that is the withdrawal method, is a very bad method of contraception. Because she's worried when you pull out on time, and he's worried when you pull out on time. Before I tell you about the research of Masters and Johnson, let me put on the table two issues that are very controversial these days. It doesn't matter where I talk. It can be at Boston College, and they have Jesuits on the board. It can be at Eckerd College last week, and it's a Presbyterian college. It can be at the University of Utah tomorrow. Wherever I go, I do say, coming out of Nazi Germany, I know one thing. You have to stand up and be counted for what you believe. I know it's controversial, but from where I stand, abortion must remain legal. Not as a contraceptive, but when there is a contraceptive failure. And I want to tell you why. Most of you are too young, but maybe somebody will remember, before July 1st, 1970, in New York State, for example, before abortion was legalized, only women with money could obtain an abortion because they could fly to Mexico and to Europe. And the others resorted to abortionists and to coat hangers. And I would find it a terrible state of affairs if we have to go back to those years. Not as a contraceptive. That's why I'm keeping talking about responsibility, and I'll give you some examples in contraception, but when there is a contraceptive failure. Now, you will never see me on television in a debate about this issue. The only time I made an exception is 2 years ago. I was invited by the Oxford University Debating Society, and that was so tempting. So there I made one exception. You will never see me debating the issue of abortion on television because nothing transpires. The other side waits until I finish, I wait until they finish, there is a shouting match, and nothing gets accomplished. I do say to those people who disagree, I say I respect your opinion. I respect the time, the effort, the money that you are putting in your stand. Let's work together to find the best contraceptive so that an abortion is not necessary. But in my way of thinking, it has to remain legal. I have another issue that is controversial, and that's the issue of homosexuality. We do not know. Here it is, the end of 1992. We do not know the etiology of homosexuality. Any homosexual couple that walks into my office with a relationship problem or with a specific sexual problem, I treat them with the same respect that I would treat anybody else. And I've made that very clear. And we do not know the etiology. John Hopkins University is doing some studies, Stony Brook, and those people who used to say the overbearing mother, not so, because that same mother has one son who lives a homosexual lifestyle and the other one who does not. So we don't have an answer. Respect, there is no question that everybody has to be respected. Let me go back to that research issue. Because these days there is some other research that is in sleep laboratories that is very interesting. But let me first tell you a few issues about the Masters and Johnson research. I'll talk about female sexuality first. Let's make believe that I have a normal curve. I'm going to give you some statistics that are not correct anymore because of talks like ours. But make believe that I have a normal curve. Masters and Johnson found that 30% of American sexually active women do have an orgasm during intercourse. 30%. Another 30% of American sexually active women do have an orgasm when the clitoris is being stimulated either before or after intercourse. And 30%, that's the number that is changing because of books and talks and more openness, but I have to use that number in order to give us a picture. 30% of American sexually active women do not have sexual satisfaction. Very often their husbands, their lovers, don't know. Because a woman can do what? She can fake it. Now, we women are very lucky. If we so desire, we can fake it. A man cannot fake an erection. Either he has an erection or he doesn't have an erection. But he can't fake it. So I gave you now 30 and 30 and 30. What do I owe you? 10. 5% of women can sit in a lecture hall like this one. They can tighten the upper thighs. They can have some erotic thoughts and dreams and fantasies. They can sit here and have an orgasm. And remember what I told you before about my never asking questions? I would never say a show of hands of who can. Many years ago, women used to saw on manual sewing machines. And in factories, from time to time, you could observe a woman sewing very, very fast, getting red in her face, afterwards having a smile on her face. I believe that's why they took manual sewing machines away from us women. In the sexological language, these women are easily orgasmic. They're having a good time. They don't need a sex therapist. What else do I owe you in order to have the normal curve? 5. The other 5% on the other extreme of that normal curve, I'm not going to discuss them here tonight, but I want you to know who they are so that we have 100%. If a woman, or a couple, but right now I'm talking about women, if a woman walks into my office, what a sex therapist does is take a sexual status examination. A physician takes a medical status examination, a psychologist or a social worker, a mental health status examination. A sex therapist takes a sexual status examination. In that very first encounter, in that evaluation, I ask very specific questions about that person's sexual life, if that's the complaint that they come to me with. If I detect in that evaluation that a woman is either an alcoholic or depressed or some other issues, I have to say that has to be cleared up before. See a psychiatrist, go to Alcohol Anonymous, because psychosexual therapy is a behavior therapy. It's short term. It would not work with somebody who is depressed. Most women who do not have sexual satisfaction can be taught, but they have to be willing, they have to give themselves permission to be pleasured. Even the best lover, even one trained by me, cannot give a woman an orgasm against her wishes. So most women in that group can be taught Most women who do have an orgasm either before or after intercourse can learn to have an orgasm during intercourse, but that's not really so important. What is important is that if she so desires, that she can have sexual satisfaction. And that's what is possible to do with this art. Psychosexual therapy is an art based on scientific facts. Let me show you what Masters and Johnson taught us about men. In this culture of ours, and we do not know why, there are many men who are what is called in the sexological language premature ejaculator. In the psychoanalytical literature, they used to teach people like me that these are men who dislike women. That's why he doesn't want to give her the pleasure of his company. That's why he goes bang, bang, thank you, ma'am. Not so. In most cases, it is a learning difficulty easily remedied. We don't know exactly why in our society there are so many premature ejaculators. There is one theory that says that maybe when that young man masturbated in the shower, he was worried about his sister banging against the door, saying, get out of there, I know what you're doing in there. But you don't have an answer. What we do know, if a couple walks into my office, if the relationship is a good one, I'm not talking about a Hollywood type. I'm talking about a basically working relationship. If the relationship is a good one, if he or she says that he ejaculates faster than he wants to, it is easily remedied with a few sessions, with a sex therapist, with homework to be done at home. Nothing is done in my office. Only talking. What has to happen is the man has to learn to recognize what is called the premonitory sensation. The premonitory sensation is that moment before the point of no return, before the moment of inevitability. Once that point of no return has passed, even a fire engine in his bedroom, he can't stop. So, premature ejaculation, and I have to tell you something from the Talmud, from the Jewish tradition. It says in the Talmud that a lesson taught with humor is a lesson retained. And that's particularly important when you talk and teach about human sexuality. So, if a couple comes, if he says he's premature ejaculating, easily remedied, homework to be done at home. Easier if he has a partner and the two of them can do those exercises, but he can even do those exercises by himself. They used to teach such men, think of some horrible exam. Think of flunking an exam. Think of somebody you don't like, or think of your favorite football team losing. Thinking that that would prevent him from, it would make him think about the other aspect, it would prevent him from ejaculating. It's exactly the other way around. He has to learn, and you can teach that, to concentrate into that sensation before that premonitory moment, before that moment of no return, when it's too late. There are some other sexual dysfunction that I told Johnny Carson a few years ago, that he single-handedly is responsible for Americans' problems in the bedroom. He said, me? How come? I said, because they are staying up to watch you. Maybe that holds true for some students. Then they are too tired. Then they try to have sex because they say, oh my gosh, I haven't had it in a while. And it doesn't work. Here is the scenario, and that has to do with that issue of sexual literacy that I talk about. Here is the scenario in many bedrooms in this country. I do not want you to call home and ask your father, did you get it up last night? Or ask your mother, do you have orgasms? Because, what I said before, I do strongly believe that sex is and ought to remain a private matter. But we have to talk about it. Here is the scenario in the bedrooms in this country. In our culture, it is mostly the husband who approaches his wife with an erection when he wants to engage in sexual activity. That has been true for a long time. It's changing a little bit. It's very interesting. It's changing, and Nancy Friday just published a book.